From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Metro Detroit's ongoing recovery from monsoon rains. Why can't our infrastructure hold up?
We're in a new normal. It's, you know, a changing climate, maybe call it global weirding, whatever term you want to use. We have these more intense rainstorms that are coming on a more regular basis.
And we check in on Michigan's vaccination rates. Rural counties in the city of Detroit are competing for the dubious title of having the least shots in arms.
The myths that people are reading about on social media platforms, and they are finding that information to be very believable.
Also, Detroit artist Bree Gant talks about working in multiple disciplines and the act of creation at walking speed.
Whether it's a hike in a metro park or a walk through the city, it's part of my practice to walk every day.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to check in with health officials in very different Michigan communities that are tackling the same problem, low COVID-19 vaccination rates.
Now we're going door to door. So, you know, there's no more excuses at all. We are doing what it takes to get shots in arms. And unfortunately, our numbers are still low.
That's coming up later in today's show. But first, Metro Detroit continues cleanup today from the weekend's flooding. Torrents of rainwater and sewer overflow gushed into streets, into homes and basements. Wayne County remains under a state of emergency, with teams trying to deal with the public health threats, the stranded vehicles, folks without power, and so much more. This is extremely frustrating for those who remember similar devastating floods in 2014 and intermittently in places all throughout the Detroit metro area. Nick Schreck is an associate professor of law at Detroit Mercy School of Law, and he focuses on environmental law and related equity issues. Nick, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So, like I said, we're just a few years removed from that last massive flood for the Detroit region. Can we truly call these 100-year floods just based on the amount of rainfall anymore?
Well, no. I mean, unless we want to say that we've had multiple 100-year floods in the last 10 years. And so, but that just totally changes the game in terms of how we plan for infrastructure, how we plan for these types of storms. And really what it is we're in a new normal. It's, you know, a changing climate, maybe call it global weirding, whatever term you want to use. We have these more intense rainstorms that are coming on a more regular basis.
Nick, writers and scientists and mappers have talked at some length about the issues that face cities like New Orleans that lie below sea level. And this is becoming an increasing conversation on the Eastern Seaboard. But a city that's geographically set the way Detroit is, should a city like ours be flooding so often?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the way that we as humans have changed the landscape. So this was an area, you know, prior to European colonization, a lot of wetlands, an area that has a lot of clay that drains towards the Detroit River, you know, drains through the Rouge Rivers or the Clinton Rivers, towards our Great Lakes. And so what we've done is through development of roads, highways, buildings, taking what were natural streams, turning them into culverts or pipes, we've really altered the landscape. And when we look at our roads in particular, these are highways that are below grade. So, you know, when we talk about Interstate 94 or I-75, these roads that have flooded this weekend and multiple times over the past 10 years, they're below the surface of the earth, right? They've been excavated. And so they have pumps that are needed to pump water off of the road surface when you have rain events. And what's happened with this flood and the flood in 2014, there was also 2016 when I-94 was flooded significantly, the pumps have failed either because of a loss of power or because they themselves have had some sort of mechanical issue. So what's different about other parts of the country is that, yes, we should be in pretty good shape, being that, the way that the natural systems here developed, it's a wet area, we've got the Great Lakes, there's a lot of water, but we've significantly altered the landscape through, you know, adding pavement and concrete and the different types of engineering that we've done here in Southeast Michigan.
Right. How do you think about the major fracture points or weaknesses in Detroit's infrastructure? We can say that the major highways are a little enough below ground that it's an issue in flooding. What else?
Right. So we also have what's called a combined sewer system in, you know, many parts of our region, including the city of Detroit. And that means that the sanitary sewer, when you flush the toilet, that's connected in many instances to the storm drains. So the culverts along the road that are supposed to move the water off the road surface. And when you have rain, even just a couple inches of rain, that combined sewer system gets overwhelmed, and that can lead to backups into people's basements, which we've all seen the horrible pictures of people, you know, moving couches, but also, you know, important family mementos and things out to the curb because of flooding. And what's important to note is that those basement backups are often include human waste, right? They often include sewage as well as other contaminants. So that's another main problem we have, is that our storm drains that deal with water, with rainwater, they're connected to our sanitary sewers.
Can I just jump in for a minute? Wasn't there a federal mandate for major American cities to deal with this?
Well, yes. And, you know, the city of Detroit was actually under a federal court order for over 30 years to deal with the combined sewer overflow issue. And we've tried, and we've gotten better in terms of treating to a very limited extent this sewer water mixed with storm water before it gets discharged into the Rouge or the Detroit River. It might get hit with chlorine for a brief amount of time to try and kill E. coli and other contaminants, but you're still seeing a lot of these overflow events happen just because of the way the system's designed. It would cost a lot of money to separate our combined sewer into storm drains and sanitary sewers. It would be expensive. And so that has been prohibitive for the region. You know, we've looked at building deep tunnels below ground to store this extra wastewater until it can be treated and discharged into the rivers, but that's also been cost prohibitive. So one approach that, you know, I've certainly pushed and many others have is trying to look towards more green solutions, more green infrastructure, meaning not depending so much on pipes, but trying to divert stormwater into wetland areas, into parks or areas of property that are vacant, and allow that water to naturally seep into the ground. I mean, that's really, I think, where we have to go, because the other solutions are just too cost prohibitive at this point.
I read that a couple of years ago, when Chicago was dealing with a big summertime flood, the city chose to bulldoze foreclosed properties, trying to avoid the problems of washed out sewer overflow, and also leaving basements intact as sort of receptacles to collect the floodwater. What issues might come up if Detroit tried to go down a similar road?
Well, there are some of those projects that are actually in place, and looking at maybe taking those areas that were basements and filling them in with, you know, crushed gravel or stone that can work as sort of a retention area for stormwater and a way for it to naturally percolate into the ground. There's some of that work being done here in Detroit as well. One concern that we always have in Detroit, being a major industrial city, is that we do have many areas of contaminated property where there are chemicals, things left over from gas stations or dry cleaners or small manufacturing operations, where, you know, whatever there is on the ground could then be seeping into the groundwater, and we would be concerned with contamination over time. So you have to be really smart about where you locate these green infrastructure projects, do soil testing and all of that to make sure you're not contributing to some sort of contamination problem by trying to solve this issue of heavier, more intense storms caused by climate change.
I mean, I'm also mindful of the way that we've seen foreclosure clearances disproportionately affect Black neighborhoods, which is a great many neighborhoods in Detroit. Something that no doubt would enter the equation as well.
Yes, and we wouldn't want those neighborhoods to be overly burdened, you know, as a stormwater retention area. I mean, you want to do this in such a way that actually beautifies neighborhoods, and that, yes, if there are blighted and abandoned properties, maybe it's worth it to remove them and put in more of like a park-like setting that at times will flood when you would have rainwater diverted there, but then otherwise would be a nice green space for the community. So there are ways to do this smartly where you're not overly burdening communities that are already suffering from so many injustices.
We just have a couple minutes left, but the city just experienced a monstrous cash windfall from the federal COVID relief effort. Mayor Duggan's listed priorities, but they don't include a major sewage or water retention project. Do you know if any of that money or any of President Biden's infrastructure deal might help the city tackle this?
Well, this is a big point of discussion right now with the proposed infrastructure bill that's coming up. You know, how much money can be set aside for things like climate resiliency? And when you put climate change into the discussion, unfortunately, that then you know, loses some of the Republicans that have been negotiating for this bill. And so it's still an unknown number as to what could be invested specifically for climate change. However, sewer infrastructure, water infrastructure, those are things that definitely are considered and are have been articulated as things that are goals of President Biden's infrastructure plan. As far as the COVID relief money, I think that's a bit more challenging because it wasn't specifically directed to things like, you know, wastewater infrastructure or drinking water infrastructure. However, there may be some funds available for transit, which perhaps could lead to, you know, less reliance on using these roads that have been flooding. You know, perhaps more people riding transit, we can take some of the money that's needed to maintain and expand roads and invest into more public transportation options. But with the infrastructure bill currently working its way through Congress, there's still a lot of unknowns there. And I would think with the flooding in Detroit, as well as the excessive heat out west, that this discussion of climate change, you know, again, should be front and center. And hopefully there will be dollars to help communities adapt and be more resilient in the face of a warming climate.
You know, it is a little dizzying, though, when you think about the fact that the number of jurisdictions that would have to be involved to secure the highways, to secure the sewage systems, you know, deal with the power problems that are a part of this. There, we should mention there was a pretty big AT&T outage in Southeast Michigan that knocked out a lot of people's phone service, mobile phone service. I mean, who's the right? Is it the state's job to coordinate something like this?
Well, certainly with looking at the highway issue and the flooding issue, I mean, that's something that the Michigan Department of Transportation would take a lead role on, you know, working with the different municipalities where those roads pass through to make sure that they've got, you know, better plans in place. I mean, what's frustrating is this isn't new. I mean, there are, you know, many advocates have been calling for, you know, additional flood planning, for green infrastructure planning to be a part of highway projects for many years. And so, you know, really the state's behind the curve on this, and they need to get ahead of that curve, or we're going to continue to have these problems. But yes, I see a major role for state government here and for our Environment, Great Lakes and Energy Department to be in a leadership role, because you're right, there are multiple jurisdictions that where these roads and major infrastructure passes through. I mean, just our drinking water and wastewater system in Southeast Michigan, there's, you know, over 100 communities that are connected there. So you need to have some of that regional and state planning to help us get to where we need to be.
Nick Schreck, an associate professor at Detroit Mercy School of Law. Nick, it's great talking to you. Thanks for making time.
Thank you.
Coming up, Detroit artist Bree Gantt talks about fluidity of form and fluidity of thought.
Working across various mediums and in so many spaces, like, just really spoken to me about what it means to be an artist, what it means to be a human, and what it means to accept and just witness yourself.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. He or she, dancer or painter, either or. So much about how we think about the world happens in categories and boxes. But in our conversations with LGBTQ artists this month, Pride Month, we've been taking a closer look at the fluidity of the human experience. Maybe there should be some fluidity in how we talk about creative experience, too. Detroit-born and bred artist Bree Gantt embodies this. Her work has transitioned from filmmaking and photography into performance and sound art. Bree's work has won the attention of some real powerhouses, including the Red Bull Artist Residency and Kresge Arts, among others. And Bree joins us today to talk about her work and her process. Bree, welcome to Stateside.
What up, though? Thank you for having me.
Could you describe for us what kind of directions your practice is in these days? How do you describe the art that you're making and how you create?
Man, that is definitely constantly shifting, and I'm trying to ground myself in a place where that's okay. You know, it's organic, things grow and change, and it feels often like working against the mainstream or how we're traditionally understanding things go, because, you know, you have to have a brand and be consistent. But right now I'm much more interested in care and wellness and centering in embodied practice and being a model, not just for thoroughly understanding beauty and aesthetics, but incorporating and integrating that into our lives. And what does it look like to make taking care and building equitable cities as an art practice?
Everything you just said, I feel like, just puts such a highlight on all the fluidity that's happened in the art world, you know, just in the years of your professional life, the thought of artists needing a brand, you know, and kind of getting themselves out there in that way, depending on what kind of practice they work in, and mm-hmm. the need for self-care, and the need for equitable practice, and the need for being a part of the community. There's a lot there. How is this? How would you say it's different than you went to school at Howard University? How would you say things are different in your practice than, say, 10 years ago?
Oh, man. I mean, honestly, I feel like it's coming full circle. I only recently started dancing again. I went to school for film, and I didn't make my first short film until a few years ago. So you know how you realize how you catch up to yourself sometimes mm-hmm. in life. I'm definitely doing things more intentionally and on purpose. I didn't consider myself an artist until a few years ago, or I just had trouble. I thought that was like a title bestowed upon you by some gods of the art world elsewhere, and not something that I could like claim for myself and understand as a way of approaching building a career and building a life and really intentionally leaning into this idea of form and function. I actually went to school for international business and ended up switching to film, which I think we're in conversation with each other. I was interested in global conversations. I'm interested in the ways that we build infrastructure for ourselves and our lives and the way that we share our stories with each other. And I went from documenting and being a photojournalist and studying film to this space when I moved back to Detroit of really being interested in the relationship between self and other and branching out beyond film and photography to various mediums to really explore that concept.
Yeah. What did you take away from your years from your time at Howard?
Well, one of the main things was I had culture shock when I got there. I was like, wait, there's this many different types of Black people. No one tells you that. In Detroit, you grow up as a talented young person and everyone tells you to leave, that this isn't the real world, that you have to go beyond here to be successful, to learn, to connect. And I got to Howard and it was very humbling and very eye-opening to experience a global diaspora on one college campus and to understand how big the world is and how connected we all are beyond just race, but especially like understanding how much bigger Blackness was than just Six Mile. It was very affirming to understand that I could relate to someone from across the world through this this beautiful network of the diaspora.
Yeah. If you don't mind my asking, did you come out while you were at college?
I did. I came out at Howard. I tell people Howard is so many beautiful people. I was like, what? You guys cornered me into. This isn't right. There's so much more to be.
What did you observe in terms of the queer community there? And maybe how was there some differences between what you found there and the queer community that you find in the Midwest?
Yes, there was. Like the queer community on the East Coast is a lot. Okay, this is going to sound strange. When I say more queer, I mean more in the fluid and just not cis heteronormative ways of living, as opposed to gay, if that makes sense. Like I learned a lot more about the LGBTQ plus. Like I learned a lot more about the plus than about the, you're just lesbian or straight or a gay or a bi.
Right.
And I've seen that more that I've been home now. I mean, I didn't realize how conservative Detroit was until I moved back home. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing there just wasn't, we didn't allow ourselves that room to grow. The queer scene in Detroit was a lot more underground, especially back when I came out in college. And the queer scene on the East Coast was just, it was a whole world way of being outside of relationships. It wasn't like relegated to who you were with and have sex with, but like it there was just a lot more room to move and understand your gender and sexuality and all that jazz.
Right. I wanted to ask a little bit about your dance practice, because as you said, you were a dancer long before you were in school for film. What happened? I mean, was dance sort of always happening on the side for you, or did it just sort of go on the back burner for those years?
It was happening on the side. I was very insecure about my dancing growing up. I didn't take like studio classes. I wasn't with, you know, like how some folks study since they were three with the same studio and teacher. I kind of just wanted to dance. And I was definitely in every school talent show, but I was not always in class. And my career kind of took that path too. When I went to high school, when I went to college, I auditioned for companies and I made the companies, but I always made it as an apprentice because my technique wasn't there. But I was passionate. You could see that I loved moving and engaging with my body, but it wasn't necessarily I didn't have a rigorous technical practice or
your physical language looks kind of flowing somewhere between an expression and a stretch. Are you conscious of keeping a sense of inquisitiveness or a sense of exploration in your choreography?
Yes and no. I just arrived here. I had the amazing opportunity of doing a dance-based performance artist residency with Jennifer Harge, Daring Dances, and Skeleton Architecture out of New York. And it was called The Gathering, and it kind of formed into, completely changed the way that I engaged my art practice. And it was about witnessing, it was about improvisation and how improvisation guides us through movement throughout the day, not just as a dance practice, and what it means to be a Black woman or non-binary person and move freely and witness each other moving freely. And so improvisation has become a core of my practice. It was something that I othered before, that I thought wasn't for me, that I thought was for these typical modern dance classes, and you had to have certain skills and be able to do certain tricks. But I'm really understanding the art of dance and movement and aesthetic as really coming out of this improvisation.
I don't know why this struck me so much, but your work seems to unfold at a pace that might suggest walking or evolving thought. It's a very human pace. Does that concept resonate with you at all?
Absolutely. Walking is a core of my art practice. It has been for years, mostly since undergrad. I mean, I love whether it's a hike in a metro park or a walk through the city, it's part of my practice to walk every day. And I'm very much, and also other dance from me, because I was into meditation and stillness, but I'm learning where those things balance and engage each other. And I'm interested in this idea of presence and meditation in our everyday life. How do we bring in that mindfulness into our everyday personal art practices?
Yeah. You've also done a lot of work around taking the bus in Detroit, which I love. There's a film, Riding with Aunt D-Dot, and there's some walking involved in that too. What did it mean to think about the mode of transportation in your creative practice?
That's also, it's movement. I love movement work. It's definitely the core of my art practice, but I loved taking the train when I was in undergrad in DC. It was so freeing. I would often skip class to just take the train and people watch and,
wow,
and take pictures of folks. And it was a place where I found a lot of agency, personal agency, and ways to be an active part of my life and a part of the community that I live in. And when I moved back to Detroit, I was on my way to a job interview. I was waiting on the bus on Grand River, a major street in the city. And it took an hour and a half to get here. And I was like, what? How am I gonna make this work? And so it's been a study for me ever since. And I still feel the same way about public transportation. I love the bus, even when I'm frustrated with it. I think it's a great way to be an active member of your community, literally just to take the bus. And it's also a way to learn yourself and learn your agency and just take charge of your life and be a part of your city and community. There's so much inspiration for me on the bus.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Detroit artist Bree Gantz. Their work can be seen as part of the Queer Art Pride digital book and print fair right now. And there's also some evolving videos that you'll want to keep an eye on coming out of their work with Kresge. Bree, you've talked about your own identity in non-binary terms. Could you talk a little bit more about how and if that permeates your art practice?
For sure. I think I came to understanding my gender as non-binary. Non-binary woman is how I identify. I'm interested in this fluidity and this integration of self. I am very much into the divine feminine and divine masculine and all that jazz. And I appreciate gender roles. Like, I understand socializing social constructs. I understand why we make them. But I think we've also put ourselves in these prisons and just really we've allowed our creations to dictate who we are. And it's something that I've been working through in my art practice and having this relationship to self that isn't filtered through society's concept of me and society's perception of me, but really starting with myself and starting with my care and my wellness and my awareness of how I feel and who I am. And that gender, sexuality, these are something that are part of you for life, but you experience them differently as you grow and evolve. And I'm really appreciating the way art has allowed me to see more of myself in that way. And I think it's less about me not being a woman. Like, that's, I don't understand my, like, not identifying as a woman. It's just my gender experience is a lot greater than that, like literally not binary. You can't fit it into a binary concept. And working across various mediums and in so many spaces like galleries or with city government or in the classroom or literally in public space and parks has just really spoken to me about what it means to be an artist, what it means to be a human, and what it means to accept and just witness yourself.
You've talked about your interest in the self and the other and how this comes up in a lot of different kinds of the work you do. What's compelling for you about how those concepts play out in our lives?
Everything, man. One of my favorite things that I've only recently begun to understand is what Toni Morrison would say about racism being a distraction. And I think so many people interpret that so many different ways, but she's not saying racism isn't real, racism isn't an issue. She's saying that that's not something that we can focus on. And I've been coming to understand this social justice work as starting with self and understanding the ways that I oppress parts of myself and seeing the way that that projects onto other people and other relationships and the way I engage the world. And that's not, you know, it's not making an excuse for not fighting injustice or systemic racism and systemic oppression. It's understanding that othering and the way we treat other people and the way we engage our communities is not isolated from how we treat ourselves. It's very much correlated and very much related to understanding how we see ourselves, how we witness and forgive ourselves and engage our care and personal wellness is the way that we set up the world around us for the most part. And so it's like, how do we start with that core unit of our relationship to self? And it's not about individualism. It's literally about how do we make this deeper connection with self in order to have deeper connections and intimacy with community and city and world.
Mm. I know you're currently working on a dance film. Is that something you can tell us more about?
Yes. So I want to, I have all the dreams, April. I would like to do screen feature length dance film. It is coming into fruition. I've been working with folks on proposals and developing and fundraising for it. And as part of the process of making and fundraising, I'm currently working on a short film, a short dance film called Mourner's Bench with dance artist and choreographer Celia Benvenuti. There's this amazing solo by American choreographer Tally Beatty that was done in 1947, and it was on a mourner's bench, a church bench. And it's this contemporary choreography about how hope and grief occupy the same space and what moving through that looks like, and especially through the lens of the Black church. And so I'm working with Celia to reset that piece on a city bus bench in Detroit. And we've been doing some test footage, and the process is, it's a really sick project, and I'm looking forward to it coming out later this year.
Well, Bree, it's been really a pleasure talking to you about what's going on these days, and we can't wait to see the unfolding of some of these projects.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Bree Gant is our guest today, an artist working in Detroit. Again, you can find their work as part of the Queer Art Digital Book and Print Fair, and keep an eye open for the films that are unfolding. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, two parts of Michigan with the lowest vaccination rates, one urban and one rural. That story in just a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The good news is that Michigan's COVID infection rates and hospitalizations are way down compared with where they were at this time in March. The bad news is, so are COVID vaccination rates. In just a moment, we'll speak with Detroit's chief public health official about the challenges in the state's biggest city. But first, we're going to find out what's going on in one of the state's more rural areas. There are places like West Virginia that have shown rural areas can be successful getting shots in arms. But for a tri-county region in the most southern part of Michigan, there's still a lot of folks who need convincing. Rebecca Burns is health officer for the Branch Hillsdale St. Joseph Community Health Agency. Rebecca, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks very much for having me.
Your health agency serves three counties in Michigan. That's about 150,000 people. How would you describe the current infection rates at the moment?
The infection rates are generally declining. They are still a little higher than other areas of Michigan, but overall, we are seeing a decline as the rest of Michigan has been.
Yeah. Can you maybe give us an idea of what it's been like over the past year and a half?
It's just been unbelievably busy. We have staff that have worked innumerable hours trying to prevent disease in community members, providing accurate information, just doing everything that they can to protect people and prevent further COVID illnesses. A lot of times under very stressful conditions, we've had some of our nurse case investigators who have reached out and have been met with folks that really don't want to hear from us and are very confrontational with our nurses sometimes. So we have calls like that, but we also have calls from folks when we're calling them to reach out that are truly opposite from that. They're very thankful for the work that we do and very complimentary of the staff of public health. So our staff here has really seen all sides of this issue and have received compliments as well as a lot of pushback. So
it's good to hear that infection rates are declining. That sounds pretty gratifying. What's been the message or the strategy for trying to get more people vaccinated this summer?
Well, what we're trying to do is expand opportunities for vaccination. So we're making sure that we're continuing to provide opportunities for folks every week in our offices. So every single office that we have in each county is providing that opportunity for residents. Beyond that, we're also reaching out to our local hospitals and providers and working to encourage them to provide vaccination to their patients. We have an ultra cold freezer available at the office and can act as a hub for our providers in the Tri-County area for the Pfizer vaccine. And we can also, of course, provide them with the other two vaccines, the Moderna and the J&J. So if we can get more providers to have those conversations with patients when patients are in the office, we are hopeful that individuals will, because they're hearing from their provider and hearing accurate information from their provider, may be more likely to go ahead and receive the vaccine at the time of their visit. So our strategy is basically to provide it everywhere everybody is, as convenient as possible. Walk-ins always an option for folks, and then to bring in additional providers to offer it.
What are folks saying to you and your staff about why they might choose not to get vaccinated?
Mostly we are hearing people use reference to the misinformation that's out there. For example, infertility being caused by getting the vaccine, or the vaccine causing illness itself. There are people that are concerned about the side effects that they might get as their body ramps up to prevent disease in the future. So that's what we're really hearing, is mostly the myths that people are reading about on social media platforms, and they are finding that information to be very believable.
How close do you think the Tri-County area is to being at a point where people might go to their doctor's office for a checkup or maybe a flu vaccine and have a conversation with their MD and be able to get it right there?
Most of the providers' offices, we're still trying to encourage them to come online and take vaccine and sign up to be a provider. We do have our hospitals that are registered providers, and we're working with them to make this part of discharge planning and ER visits, hoping to bring on urgent cares also. So I think we've got a long ways to go to get it into the office of every provider.
What do you hear from the MDs about what might make this more of a possibility for them? Is it, I mean, the cold storage is obviously an aspect with the Pfizer vaccine, but that's not the case for every kind.
There has been a lot of concern about storage and handling that we've heard from providers. The paperwork that's necessary to, you know, document, the staff time that's involved to do that, to ensure that the vaccine is properly stored and handled, can be a little daunting to someone who's not been a part of the vaccine providers for childhood immunizations or the adult program that Michigan Department of Health and Human Services has. So, you know, we're hearing that from some providers that storage and handling is a lot. And we're also hearing from some providers that, well, you know, I am encouraging my patients and I encourage them to make an appointment when they're in my office to come see you, which is fine. But if they leave that office and then don't make that appointment with us, it's a lost opportunity. So we'd really like to have providers have that in the office and can take care of that vaccination on the spot.
What do you hear from some of the MDs about what might make this more possible for them to take on? I know that cold storage is a big issue for the Pfizer vaccine, but obviously that's not an issue for some of the other kinds of doses. Was that part of the concern?
That is part of the concern. The storage and handling for this these vaccines is a little concerning and time-consuming for doctors' offices. There also may be a lack of storage in their refrigeration units too, and freezers. So that may be part of the issue. I've also had a local provider indicate that he has those conversations with patients, but then refers them to make an appointment with the local health department for that vaccine, which is fine, but it does you know, it is a lost opportunity at that moment to get that person vaccinated. They may not follow through and make that appointment with our office. And so we really want all providers to have easy access to the vaccine in their offices.
Can I just ask, as we wrap up, how you're feeling personally about the situation in your counties? There have been some really frightening moments over the course of the pandemic, but how are you feeling about things this summer?
Well, we are really, you know, in uncharted territory. We know we have a low vaccination rate. We know we have seen some of the Delta variant cases in Branch County. And yet we are still at this time seeing a slow decline in case rates. So, you know, we're hopeful that we've turned the corner and that we will continue out of this pandemic. But we are certainly concerned that due to the low vaccination rate and the fact that we have Delta cases present, that we could see an increase in cases as the summer months go on.
Rebecca Burns is health officer for the Branch Hillsdale St. Joseph Community Health Agency. Rebecca, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
So that's the story in one of Michigan's less populated areas. But cities have some different factors to deal with and some different tools to work with. Denise Fair is Chief Public Health Officer for the Detroit Health Department. Denise, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do we know about why many Detroiters are still not getting vaccinated yet? Would you say there are still issues of hesitancy and convenience?
So it's definitely not access. So the city of Detroit has done an incredible job of making the vaccine available to anyone who needs it. We started off early January going to our most marginalized communities. That's our seniors living in nursing homes and apartments and people who are experiencing homelessness. And then we partnered with the clergy to bring the vaccine to our local churches. Since then, we've been in schools and businesses. We have a large drive-through. We have walk-ups. We have weekend hours, after hours. We're even in the bars, the restaurants, and the local parks. Now we're going door to door. So there are, you know, there's no more excuses at all. We're doing what it takes to get shots in arms. And unfortunately, our numbers are still low. So we are right around 38%. And what's really interesting when we look at the data of those who are still unvaccinated, 57% are under the age of 40 years old. That's my generation. I'm really focused on making sure they have the access that they need. I am speaking to them one-on-one if I have to get past all of these myths that are found on social media. You know, people can come to the health department to get the latest and greatest truthful information when it comes to the vaccine.
How big a concern is the Delta virus variant for you right now? I mean, I was feeling like last time a variant was afoot, Michigan experienced a pretty big spike. Is it something that's on your mind very much?
Definitely what keeps me up at night. You know, when I look at the numbers, even though the percent positivity has decreased and our hospitalization and our cases, the variant is what we're closely watching. You know, we've heard reports that in the fall, it's going to get worse. But we will be prepared. And again, our focus is on education. Even though the governor has lifted all of the capacity requirements and the mask and order gatherings, we still in the city of Detroit, we want Detroiters to be safe. And that's what we're doing here.
Yeah. What are the stakes for a city that's already been hit so hard just by the first strain of COVID that was around?
Safety is at the forefront. You know, we lost over 2,000 Detroiters, and we're still continuing to lose lives. One life that we lose is too many. And so, again, my focus is making sure that Detroiters are educated. I want them to be empowered so that they make the right decision. Unfortunately, we still have people that are on the fence, and I want to reach them. I do. And I'm very concerned for their safety. I hope Detroiters make the right decision before it's too late.
Yeah. You mentioned the home visit program. I want to circle back to that for a minute. Being able to go door to door, what difference do you see this making?
So I think it's making a great difference. You know, people enjoy more of the one-on-one conversation. It's more of a personalized approach. So the way this works is that we have door knockers that are going door to door. In fact, we've gone to over 150,000 doors so far. And when we speak to the residents, if they're interested in getting their vaccine, usually that same day or the next day, we'll have a nurse come directly to their home and vaccinate them and vaccinate their entire family. So it's proven to be successful so far. And I hope Detroiters take advantage of this opportunity.
Detroit is certainly far from the only place in the state that is dealing with low vaccination rates right now. There are places in rural and suburban parts of Michigan that are also dealing with this. But what's unique about the challenge of reaching a city population for getting shots in arms?
Well, I think that the challenge is making sure that we get the word out. We have our regular press conferences. We're really active on social media. But honestly, it's the neighbors that are talking to their neighbors down the street about the importance of getting the vaccine. It's clergy speaking to their congregation about the importance of taking this step to save their lives. Also, it's the doctors. The doctors in the city of Detroit have really stepped up to have one-on-one conversations with their patients about getting the vaccine. And so far, it's proven to be successful.
Yeah. We've seen Governor Whitmer and President Biden adjusting their goals for vaccination as the rush to get the shots sort of plateaued. How is Detroit adjusting expectations and balancing that with urgency?
So this is still very much urgent. It's top of mind. Our message has not changed. It's been clear from the very beginning that COVID-19 is trying to take over the city of Detroit, and we're not going to let it. Detroit is resilient. We are people who are not going to give up. And so that's why in the health department, once again, our focus has been access. It's been education and really getting the word out there about the importance of the vaccine. So we're not going to get tired. We're not going to let our guard down. We're still going to make sure that every Detroiter who wants to get the vaccine can get vaccinated.
Can I ask a somewhat related question? There was just torrential flooding all throughout the metro area over the weekend. Are you at all worried about folks being in closer proximity as they go to family members and neighbors and try to help them out with some of the needs related to the flooding?
I am a little bit concerned, especially because our vaccination rates are still extremely low. My encouragement to those Detroiters who are concerned about safety is just to wear your mask, practice social distancing. I think that will definitely be important. But right now, we as a city need to come together to help out our brothers and sisters who have been impacted by the flooding. I know Mayor Mike Duggan and the entire leadership team, we're going to be sharing our progress towards helping Detroiters. Again, our focus is on safety.
Denise Fair is Chief Public Health Officer for Detroit's Health Department. Denise, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Ronia Cabasag, Chantel Phillips, Lucas Pollack, and Mary Claire Zowell. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.